I had was 20 years in the game. I've been writing. I was just waiting for somebody to see me, right? And to say, like, wow, and like, you lucked up.
We done lucked up on a real one. What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Tracy Michelle Lewis Gigetz, author of the essay collection Black Joy, and 15 other books. On this episode, Tracy discusses her writing journey from indie publishing to sought-after ghostwriter to stepping out of the literary shadows and standing on her own name and what she's learned along the way.
And I think this is just a life lesson that if it all goes away tomorrow, I'm going to be okay. You know, I ain't gonna like it. I'm gonna cry. I'll be like, you know, the bag is a lot lighter. like all of that. But I think coming up through like independent, it teaches you that, you know, that you're gonna survive regardless.
Tracy's roots are in Kentucky, but she left the Bluegrass State following a corporate career. With both an MBA and MFA to her name, Tracy acknowledges that she came into her role as a writer in parts and pieces. She explains how she's overcoming the need for validation and acceptance in an industry that demands it. Why it took her a long time and a This Is Us episode to understand what joy feels like in her own body. And the reason she's now focused on giving her daughter the freedom of joy she's worked so hard to find for herself. When Black and Published continues. When did you know that you were a writer?
You know, that's an interesting question because I think I've always known that I love to write, but I don't know that I always knew that I was a writer. And for me, there's a distinction. You know, I grew up, you know, writing rap lyrics and plays for my church group and all of those kinds of things. So writing has always been a part of my life. It has always been a way for me to channel how I was feeling in any given moment. But I don't think it was until my 20s where I said, you know, maybe I could really do something with this. And even then it was like, I can do this and something else. I don't think it probably wasn't even until my late 30s, early 40s, where I was like, no, this is what I need to do. Full stop.
So then in claiming that in your adulthood, that you are a writer and then going after it, because you mentioned it in the book about, you know, knowing that you wanted to do this thing deep down, but also knowing that you needed to eat.
Right.
What was your trajectory like in dipping your toe into this life of writing since you are the author of now 16 books?
Yes. I started off in poetry. I came up through Deaf Poet years, right, where everybody was trying to be the next, you know, Deaf Poetry Jam person. So I was on the circuit and doing poetry, but then realized that so much of what I wanted to say needed more words. And so started writing essays and stories and, you know, started independently as, you know, a self-published author. Published a few projects and then started writing probably about 10, 15 years ago for publication. This is also when digital, you know, started to come about and you got a chance to write for publications you never thought of because they had an online, you know, companion to their print publication. Everything was, you know, I was moving in steps, right? So the first step, I was in poetry and learning poetry. Then I decided, you know, I wanted to write prose. And then I went and got my MFA. So I switched from, I got my MBA in business because I thought, okay, I'm gonna be a business owner. And I needed it as, you know, as we all think, that fallback, right? And then, you know, immediately, not too long after that, got my MFA in creative writing because I wanted to understand the craft of what I was doing. And then started writing more publicly. And then it really is only within the last 4 or 5 years, and maybe even in the last 2 or 3, to be honest, where I just saw like an uptick in my work and how it was being received. And I don't know if that's because Black folks were in vogue because of everything that was going on in the world. And I was writing a lot about race, and I was writing, you know, about the intersections of a lot of things, right? Faith, spirituality, parenthood, the whole thing. And so it just became more appealing. I don't know what it is. I'm grateful for it.
I want to take a few steps back though. Okay. Because you said you got the MFA to learn more about the craft of writing. Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask you now, years removed from the MFA program and having major print titles to your credit, do you think the MFA helped you learn more about the craft of writing, or was it just writing in your authentic voice that helped you hone your craft of writing?
You want the honest answer, I'm assuming.
I do. I want the honest answer.
Yeah, I didn't need to do that. So here's the thing though. What I did need that MFA for, and I feel like it all kind of works together, or worked in my favor, is that I needed the MFA to get a job as a professor teaching English, right? And so that helped me to have some stability as I was doing my own work. There's so many wonderful things about MFA programs, but there are a lot of problematic things with MFA programs, particularly in this country, particularly for Black writers. So I think what I did get out of the MFA program was community, like being able to workshop and having your stuff workshop constantly having your work read, I think is important. Having someone giving you feedback, whether you agree with it or not, is important. The act of that, right? The act of submitting all the time, the act of discussing writing and discussing what you're reading, I think is incredibly important for any writer. It's just that I don't know if you need to pay to go to school to do that. None of my agents, none of my work ever came from anybody or any contact via MFA. There were other communities and other writing groups that definitely, absolutely, 100% were critical in my success and my journey, right? But I can't say the MFA program gave me that. But I think what helped me was that it provided an opportunity for me to have a position. And so now I'm at this crossroads now where the writing has kind of surpassed what I'm doing in academia. And so now I have other decisions I have to make. So I don't think any writer needs it.
Okay. And so did you self-publish your first novels and first books after your MFA program or before?
That was all before. In 2002, yeah, I published my first little poetry collection. And then my first novel was 04, and then 09, and then 12. And I didn't graduate from the MFA program till 13. So a lot of my independent publishing, I started my own publishing company. I was like, I got this MBA for something. Let me try to see if I can not only do my thing, but also bring other folks along for the ride. So a lot of the independent work was very early on up until, I was still might put something out independently, right? Like, so I can't say it's over, but definitely the bulk of it was those first 10 years.
What was that like? I like talking to people who self-published like in the early days of the internet. Like I talked to somebody who self-published in 1995.
Ooh.
Right. So like you self-publishing in 02, what was that like?
It was interesting because I had no idea. I had no idea what I was doing, right? Especially with the two poetry collections. I can't say with my novel, what was interesting was I remember in 03, somebody said Book Expo of America, like you should go, right? And this and that year, I think it was in Los Angeles. It was in LA. And I was like, you know, I was really in starving artist mode at that point. And so I was like, oh, how am I going to get to LA? And I remember I had friends who was like, okay, here's a couple dollars. And I put some money together for a little hotel room by LAX. And I flew out there. And I thought, because I didn't understand that Book Expo America, which is like this huge trade show, I didn't understand that it was a trade show and that this is where booksellers come and figure out what's new and get their orders. I was in the mindset of, oh, this is just like you get your table and you sell your books. So I thought, okay, well, this is going to be perfect. And so I went out there with that mindset. And then when I realized, oh, I'm not going to sell a daggone thing out here. So that's how I say that to say, like, that's how green and how I didn't know anything about it. And that's also what pushed me to say, okay, wait a minute, I need to understand what this business is. You know, if I'm going to be putting my work out of the world, that period of time was, like I said, pre-internet. It was about, I hate to say it because I don't really like this word, but like the hustle. Right. Like it was about, you know, how many events can you go to? How many, you know, tables can you set up at the festival? How many, you know, how do you get your book into the hands of people who want it? You know, I tapped my sorority. I tapped my, the church groups. And I tapped at that time, I was writing a lot of Christian fiction. So like, you know, I was tapping the churches. I remember sitting in somebody's salon reading poetry while people were getting their feet done and they're getting their hair done. And like, you know, they were like, oh yeah, girl, they bought all my books out. Like that's the kind of things that, you know, I was in salons and, you know, church groups and just really a lot that people wouldn't even think of now because they're like, oh, I'll just put it, you know, let people know on social media, you what I'm doing. That wasn't a thing at all.
I mean, I just came back from a book festival where you set up a table and I got beat up by the weather. And I was like, yeah, I can't keep living my life like this. This is not cute.
You do get to that point. You absolutely do. And again, there's no shade to any, you know, that's part. I think that's like the training ground. You learn how to talk about your book. Right. You learn how to do that 30-second, like, because you only got somebody's attention while they're in front of you. You learn so much from that process, but it does get old. But I think it's a good training ground.
So then coming from that training ground and then going through the MFA and then having bigger opportunities because of the zeitgeist moment of, you know, all things Black being in vogue because of the trauma that was in the world. How has the transition then been for you into traditional publishing?
It's been great on one hand, fascinating, like to have other people do stuff for you that you would normally do, like negotiating, you know, certain things. And, you know, I don't like negotiating money. Right. And so, you know, to have someone for you to just tell somebody, this is what I would like to have. And then they go out and do the, you know, the legwork. That is really cool for me. but I think that there are some things that, you know, I miss because you do lose some of the ownership and the autonomy, you know, you have to go back and forth with book covers, you know, like there's a lot of things that you have to compromise, sometimes in good ways, sometimes in not so great ways, that you don't have to do when it's all you and you are, you know, you are the final say. But I can say that I think I'm grateful for that training ground because it taught me how to speak for myself. It taught me how to ask for what I want and to not necessarily be afraid of just because, okay, you know, I started ghostwriting it's probably about like 6 or 7 years ago. And when I first started, I didn't know anything about what I was not getting what I should have been in terms of paying. But I learned from that experience. I talked to other ghostwriters. I got a chance to learn. And so now being able to speak for myself and ask and not be afraid that, oh, because it's this big person or this publishing house or this, you know, I don't necessarily have that kind of consciousness. And part of it is at the end of the day, when you have independently published and you know how to sell books, you can get out there. You know, you don't want to lose your opportunity in the traditional realm. But if you do,
it's not going to stop.
Right. Like,
I'm going to put this book out. I'm going to go out to this thing and I'm going to sell it and it's going to be all right.
Right. You're still like, I had an amazing editor at Gallery and Simon & Schuster. They've been great. I have amazing agents. I don't have no beef with any of them. But I also know, and I think this is just a life lesson, that if it all goes away tomorrow, I'm going to be okay. You know, I ain't going to like it. I'm going to cry. I'll be like, you know, the bag is a lot lighter. like all of that. But at the end of the day, I'm going to be okay. And I think coming up through like independent, it teaches you that, you know, that you're going to survive regardless.
So when you started doing your traditional publishing, did you go through academia? Was that where you first started trying to hone that academic voice?
No. As a matter of fact, I probably should have done more academic writing, but I did not. Interestingly enough, I was part of a really amazing writers group called UPod, and right around with everything that was going on with George Floyd and all of that, they had begun to offer scholarships for Black writers to participate in their, you know, I think it's like quarterly, they have like this meeting where you get a chance to actively pitch major publication stories. And I had been doing the ghosting already. And I had published in a few places. I had published in Essence and Ebony and, you know, some of like our publications, but had never been able to crack some of the Washington Post and that kind of thing. And so I got a chance to pitch a piece on Black joy to the Washington Post. And the crazy thing about this is that like I am an introvert. And so I love to be behind the screen. I love to either be on the stage or behind the screen, but nothing in the middle. And so I had to, in front of this real small group of, you know, other writers, pitch my idea, and I was terrified, and I almost didn't. This is crazy, because I almost did not do it. I was like, well, man, I don't know if they're going to be interested in Black joy as resistance. And then, you know, it's been done and blah, 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 but I have a different take on it. And so there was a woman in one of the smaller groups that said, no, just do it. I mean, what do you have to lose? And I pitched it and they loved it. I wrote it. It went live. And it just so happened that my ghostwriting agent sent it to the agent of one of my ghost clients, who was like, is she agenting it for her own stuff? And she was like, no. And it just kind of, everything sort of snowballed. And so we put together a proposal. I took a lot of the work. I had already been writing so much. My agent laughs at me because I'm always pulling stuff out of the vault. Well, you know, if you need a children's book, here you go. If you need a novel, because she was like, what have you? I was like, you got me. I was 20 years in the game. I've been writing. I was just waiting for somebody to see me. Ooh. Right? And to say like, wow. And like, you lucked up, because you plucked me out of, you know, relative. I mean, people knew who I was, but like relative anonymity. Right. And I have all of this content and I'm just ready. You know, I got a script. You need a TV show. Here you go. like she laughs at me. She's like, okay, slow down. Okay. Let's pump the brakes a little bit. But we, you know, within a couple of months, we had gone to auction with Black joy, and you know, everything that kind of snowballed. And so it's so different, this world that I'm in now. I'm so grateful for it. But as I said, I try to stay steady too.
So since you mentioned that essay, because I remember when it went live. So since we're here now, let's do the reading that I can ask you questions from the book.
All right, Black and Published family. Black Joy, Stories of Resistance, Resilience, and Restoration is an essay collection chronicling Tracy's life through experiences that include the deeply traumatic to those that have brought her profound joy, love, and healing. All right, Tracy, it's all yours.
Okay, awesome. I am going to read from chapter 8, We've Always Known. And so it's, you know, just as a kind of like an intro to it. You know, I'd gone through in 2019, I had a health crisis, and, you know, I was learning and figuring out what had been held inside my body for so long. And this is at the same time, again, that my therapist is asking me, what does joy feel like in your body? And I'm like, I don't have a clue. And so this is all kind of coming together in the writing that I end up doing, you know, for this book. More than I care to admit, I treat my body like a frenemy, like a loyal friend who is treated like trash because I never learned how to love her. She's always there, but I don't always trust her. I make up stories about why she's doing what she does. Most of those stories are rooted in half-truths, what I need to tell myself in order to survive the day. My legs hurt because of fibromyalgia. True. They also hurt because I'm weak. Not true. They hurt because I didn't exercise. Half true. Or because I work too much. Half true. That back and forth makes it challenging to dig past the obvious, throbbing muscles and deep aches, and find the source. Trauma trapped in muscles, a memory hiding in my knees. Because how do you explain that? Oh, there's my abuse acting up again. The hard truths aren't acceptable. And while yearning to be seen and understood by anyone about anything shouldn't necessarily be a priority when one is trying to manage chronic pain and heal from trauma, it sometimes feels like the only normality I have left. And so I grasp it tight. I hold it until my knuckles turn white, because letting go will hurt too damn much. During that downtime, the hunger to know what was going on with my body was real. I felt like I was trapped in a shell that would only allow me a few hours of energy and relatively painlessness a day. So I devoured books and articles about the relationship between PTSD and physical illness. I tried every healing modality available to me. I prayed, I cried, and then I researched some more. I learned about the real waves disease is fueled by trauma. I could finally connect the dots between the PTSD I already lived with, the breakneck speed at which I was working, the racial violence that had recently touched my family, and my body's complete breakdown. But before I could throw a pity party and cry out, why me, I shifted my reading and conversations to the ways in which the body can also restore itself, the way movement and meditation can shift the nervous system back into a healing state. And it all sounded incredibly familiar. Everything I was uncovering was made real in the stories I'd heard of late night country juke joints, where the swaggy twist and lusty grinding of bodies to the rhythm of their blues gave an inexplicable relief to a people who held back their grief out of fear of white terror and disregard. It was made real in my memories of church ladies rocking back and forth, front to back, in the Black churches of my childhood, the way they stomped a hole in the floor and screamed out in pure elation or agony, depending on the Sunday. I've come to realize that they instinctually knew how to move that trauma out of our bodies. We gravitated to things like dance and sports and music, not just because that's what white folks allowed us access to, not just because we were forced at one point to entertain them, but because in a way, it was our saving grace. It was physiologically the way we healed ourselves. And maybe that's how we were able to not only survive with our humanity intact, but also retain our joy.
So first, what made you want to write about Black joy in all of its myriad forms and all the ways that it can be used, while also threading your own personal history through that text?
Mm-hmm. So as I was saying earlier, like at this time in my life, my therapist was asking me, what does joy feel like in your body? And I couldn't really access it. And I didn't understand why I couldn't access it. I mean, surely I've had joy in my life, right? Like, you know, but I didn't know what it felt like in my body. I couldn't tell you a moment, because every time I told, you know, said, oh, well, this was a joyful moment, it was always cradled in or couched in some other not so joyful thing. And so I began to think about that. And when I pulled it out of the personal into the collective, I said, I wonder, like, if that's what Black joy is this idea of joy, which is a natural human thing that everyone has, but that has to be resilient, that has to live within the context of the historical trauma that we have, and still overcome or still survive. And I knew if I was going to write a book about Black joy, that I needed to understand how that showed up for me personally, right? Because, you know, we're not monolithic. I'm not speaking to every Black person in the world. And I think the reason why the essays kind of come out the way that they do is because what I'm saying is that if we dig beyond this white supremacist society, or even, you know, for Black women, misogyny noir, or like all of this stuff, you know, that we deal with on a daily basis. If we can dig behind it, you know, maybe we can get to the core of who we are as human beings and the core of our joy. Right. And so I think, you know, the book is this intersection between the personal and the collective. Right. So I'm coming in and out. I'm telling my story because that's the only thing I got. Right. Is my story and my experience with joy. And, you know, as I was writing this book, I'm mining my memories. Right. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about my first love. I'm thinking about that time, you know, when I decided to wear my hair the way I wanted to, and who cares what anybody thinks about it. You know, I'm thinking about all these moments, and I'm trying to access the joy in those moments. And then I am then thinking about all of us and all the ways that we try to access joy in spite of, right? And so like the baseline is that first essay with me dancing with my daughter in the rain, you know, in the middle of a contentious election, right? And knowing that the Trump supporter that's next door to me, you know, may look at that as some way, in some way, you know, but also not wanting to centering that person's gaze, right? So that was both the intention and the challenge of this book, was like the personal, weaving my personal story in with our collective story in order to kind of say that this is what Black joy is, what it can be, you know, what it sometimes looks like, what its challenges are, all the things, right? After writing this book, a part of it was looking at joy as like liberation work.
But as I was reading, and got to the middle of the book in the essay, Joy is a Gap Filler, you asked this question twice. How does one be Black, a woman, have joy, and stay safe all at the same time? I felt like that was like the seminal question and the crux of the book. So what is your answer to your own question?
The only answer that I have figured out so far is just with intention. Because if I stick with each one of those identities, right? Like if I focus on what it means to be Black, if I focus on what it means to be a Black woman, if I focus on what it means, to, like dot, right? All the things, I could probably get hung up on the challenges, the traumas, all of that. And so I think the answer is to intentionally seek out opportunities for joy, to intentionally access joy. I have a piece in there called This Is Me, which, and it's real corny, right? Like I'm watching This Is Us. And, you know, I realize while watching this random nighttime drama television show, what it feels like in my body to experience, to be like super happy, right? And for the first time paid attention to like the feeling in my hands and the feeling in my face and the feeling in my body. And the reason why is not anything that has to do with This Is Us, is that now when I need it, I am very intentional about calling that memory up and calling that feeling up in my body, right? You know, I'm not saying just live in oblivion, right? But then also choosing to go and play in the leaves with my daughter, or choosing, you know, things that will make me happy, right? To bring me joy. I think that's the only answer. And I don't even know if that's right. Like I'm posed the question because I'm still asking it.
I like that you say on page 136 that no matter how much we want it to be true, Black joy isn't Black happiness. How do you define and differentiate between the two?
I see happiness as a moment by moment thing. I feel like happiness is temporary, right? I think, you know, happiness is, ooh, I get to go to the concert, right? Joy is the feeling that you have while you're there at the concert and you're with your girls and that, you know, and you're singing the music, the lyrics out loud, and you're dancing with abandon. And like, so I think the difference is happiness comes and goes. But joy is a steady thing that exists that gets activated when you're happy, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it gets activated in a particular moment, but it's always there. And I think that's what I, you know, I tap in, I talk a lot about like the ancestors, right? Because I think they understood that a little bit better, that it was that thing that couldn't be stolen, right? So like, you know, I may have a happy moment, you know, I may have a not so happy moment, but my joy is always there. And in the happy moments, of course, it gets activated more, it gets amplified more, but you can tap into joy in painful moments, in hardship, in trauma, right? Like you can tap into that, right? And that's where like the physical body comes into play, right? Because in the hardest moments, Grandmama Nim knew to rock, right? You know, like to me, that's the manifestation of joy. It's rocking, is moving, you know, it's bilateral stimulation. It's moving, it's neurological. It's moving that trauma, that pain out. But like joy is something that is always present. And it's just up to us to access it.
Yeah. You talk a lot in this book about the need for acceptance, the need for validation, the need to be seen. You usually have two essays like that, accepting, non-acceptance, and to be seen. So with this book out, how do you feel internally about your own, I guess, quest for Black joy, Black liberation, but also, you know, those professional markers of I did it, I made it, I'm here.
You're tapping into, now you're trying to make me cry. I knew you was going to do it.
No. Okay. So look, I'm asking the question because I identified with those feelings and then I felt dragged by your words. So I have to ask because
no, it's fine.
I'll get dragged by my scalp and I not understand why.
No, I feel like I say that about tears because I was actually just sitting with that, you know, this morning as well as previous morning, because I will be, to be honest, of course, I want this thing to blow up. I wanted to do all the things. When I started getting like the blurbs, I was so excited. I was like, oh my God, they like me. They really like me, you know, like, but what I've come to, what I'm coming to learn is that, you know, validation has to be internal first. And I have to, my word for 2021 was worthy. Like I do a lot of inner child work. So little 8-year-old Tracy knows that she's worthy, whether or not it hits the New York Times bestsellers list, whether or not, you know, millions of people buy the book, whether or not, like it, at its core, I am worthy of that thing should it come, but that thing doesn't define my worthiness. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It's hard because, and you know this, right? Like as writers, you know, validation is built into the work, right? Like you're not putting this in a book format so it can sit on your table. You want people to read it and like it and tell people about it. It's built into the job. But if you're like me and, you know, that's the only way that you know, as a child, even, you know, in your early adulthood, that was the only way you understood your value. And the only way that you understood your worth was by performing, right? Then that can be a little complicated, right? You're in this field now that is the basis of it is validation, external validation and praise and being seen. And what I am working on every day is to not let high praise or high critique devastate me, right? I mean, I poured a lot of personal stuff out in this book. Things that I don't think I ever thought I would put out into the world about my life, my own trauma, my own journey. Stuff that even my husband was like, "You sure you want to say that?" You know, he's like, "That's a lot." I'm like, "Yeah." And so it's hard not to think like if people don't like that, like I put my heart in that. What are you saying? You know. But at the end of the day, my core understanding is that I did my best work. I did my best work, and that's all I got until the next thing. And so I think there's a part of me that's just trusting that, that's okay. And whatever happens, happens. But that's an ongoing thing. So like you triggered something, because that's an ongoing work to not be moved by the high highs or the low lows, and just to try to remain steady. And to, you know, I have a book that's coming out in the fall of 2020. So I literally moved from one book to the next. And so just keep working, just keep doing my best work every single time. And to me, I feel like that will sustain me. I surely hope that it does.
All right. We'll put a pin in that, and I'm going to move to a quick speed round, a little game, and then we'll let you get out of here for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
Book?
Yes, book.
There's like a bunch of books.
Your favorite book today?
Today? I mean, 15 books hit my head at once. This ain't it, but I'm gonna give it to you anyway. Let's just say Sula by Toni Morrison.
Okay, this is hilarious. Who is your favorite author?
No.
Yes. Give me top five.
Oh, okay. I could do top five. Toni Morrison is definitely like the godmother for me. Ntsasaki Shange. K.S.A. Lehman is a favorite of mine. I'm going to give you those top three for right now.
Okay. Who is your favorite poet?
Between Sonia Sanchez and Rita Dove, maybe?
This is the question I always ask my poets. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between poetry and spoken word?
I think spoken word is poetry animated. I think there are more ways in which poetry on the page can be expressed, like forms, right? So if I'm using a, you know, villanelle versus a ballad versus a sonnet versus a haiku, I think maybe in some ways, especially when we talk about like the oral traditions of Black folks and spoken word, I think it is rooted in rhythm in a different way. Spoken word has a different rhythm, different cadence. It's maybe a freer version of the poetry on the page, a more liberated version of the, that's up for debate, but I think that, you know, that's what first comes to mind.
You talk a lot about food in this book, specifically that you like sugar on your grits and you.
Yes, ma'am.
I knew that was coming. and then spaghetti in the chili. So. And I'm originally from Chicago, by the way. So here we are. And I say that with no judgment. What is your favorite meal and or dish to eat or prepare?
Well, I like a lot of things. I'm a fan of Indian food, East Indian food. I'm also a fan of West Indian food. Right now, what I'm loving, because I'm plant-based, so what I'm loving is my husband makes his Salisbury steak, but he uses the Impossible meat, you know, with it, with like mushroom gravy and mashed potatoes. And like, you can do any kind of, like, you can do cabbage or peas or like, but I don't know, like, I think because it's winter time and I'm craving like warmth and like stuff that sticks to your bones, as my grandmother used to say, that I think that's my favorite right now. I'm plant-based now, but I miss seafood. So if I really was honest about my favorite, it's the very thing I can't eat right now, which is like crab legs and just everything, lobster, all kinds of seafood. That's probably my favorite, and my favorite to cook, fried fish, the whole nine. And I can't eat any of it right now. So there's that.
Name three things on your bucket list.
One of them I can't talk about, but
okay.
I'm working with a particular person that I've always wanted to work with that I really admire. So that's the bucket list. I guess I can't, you know, can't say too much about, but you'll know it when it hits.
Stay tuned.
I want to visit a place I haven't gone before, was South Africa. I want to visit Cape Town. in Johannesburg and basically all of South Africa. I want to travel cross country in a car or train without fear.
Like Gail and Oprah?
Not quite. But I the idea of just like being able to see this country and all of its good, bad, and ugly without fear is interesting to me. So that's probably on my list too.
Okay. And so what brings you joy?
My daughter. She works my nerves, but she brings me the ultimate joy. She is like a little mirror in my life. And she is also very much the free version of myself right now. And so she's able to experience the world in a very different way than I was able to, because I've given her that. And it's just amazing to me. And I often think about like, ooh, what if I had had, you know, the freedom to speak in that way or to say, you know, how I was feeling or, yeah. So I think she brings me the ultimate joy. And most of everything that I do is because I want to leave a legacy for her that she can be proud of.
So I want to move to my little game. It's called Rewriting the Classics.
Okay.
What's the one book you wish you would have written?
Ooh, I'm going to be real shallow. I wish I wrote Beloved. I want the Nobel. So that's real shallow because obviously Toni Morrison is like the godmother. I love her. She's brilliant. You know, all the things, right?
Yeah, but it's the Nobel Prize.
But it's the Nobel Prize. And then, you know,
yeah. What's the one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
Ooh. I don't really believe in that. As much as I may not like an ending, I don't believe in like I don't think I would, if I had the chance to change it, I don't think I would. Only because I feel like as a writer myself and as an author, we have our reasons, right? Like we have, you know, and so I would never want to interject my reasoning or superimpose my reasoning over the author's. I can just not like it. But I don't think that's something I would do. I can't think of one because I don't think that that's something I would do. I mean, there's plenty of my own endings I would change. the first three novels that I wrote, like for sure, I would do a lot of reworking. So I'm holding my hands to prevent myself from going back in and trying to edit all my old books, you know, before this one comes out. And I'm not going to do that because I don't have time. But, you know, there is that feeling that I would definitely change my own stuff.
All right. So my last question for Rewriting the Classics. And so it's a little petty question. Name a book that you think is overrated and why?
Oh, child.
Or for the academic in you, a book that you think is overtaught.
Well, I think all of the so-called American classics are overtaught. Everything from Fitzgerald to like all of them, Grapes of Wrath, all of it. I mean, I'm sure my colleagues may not like it, but whatever, you know. I now think Alice Siebold is overrated.
Baby, that's a mess. That is a
whole... And I feel very comfortable in saying that.
Everyone who knows the story behind that should feel very comfortable in hearing it. So yeah, exactly. I'm going to leave that there. My last question for you today, Tracy. Mm-hmm. When you are dead and gone among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy that you've left behind?
She tried. She tried to live free. She tried to heal. And she tried to bring that freedom, that healing, that joy, that love, that peace to the people around her. And that she didn't get it all the way right all the time. But she lived in a perpetual state of trying. Mm. And because I think that's all we can do. I mean, of course, and she was a brilliant writer with multiple awards, but she tried.
Ashe. Thank you, Tracy.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Tracy for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Tracy's essay collection, Black Joy, out now from Simon & Schuster Gallery Books. And if you're not following Tracy, follow her on the socials. She's at TM Lewis on Twitter and TMLG Writer on Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Tracy about embracing the scariness of telling her truth. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holla at y'all next week. Peace.